So much for the divine warrior of the Book of Exodus. What of the divine legislator? What of what we called at the beginning of this chapter the third crescendo? It begins with a preliminary statement of the Mosaic Covenant just before the Theophany at Sinai. The Lord called to Moses from the mountain, saying, "Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob, and declare to the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to me. Now then, if you will obey me faithfully and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples. Indeed, all the earth is mine, but you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel." Moses came and summoned the elders of all the people and put before them all that the Lord had commanded him. All the people answered as one, saying, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." After this statement of what might be described as covenant goodwill on both sides, and after the Sinai Theophany already described, there comes the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments, and a code of more particular regulations that scholars have come to call the Book of the Covenant. This longer code governs life in a settled agrarian society with vineyards, livestock, and various kinds of property to attend to. The Decalogue, in its extraordinary economy and lapidary strength, has proven itself to be the least culture-bound moral code ever written. But the Book of the Covenant is quite another matter. Historians correctly note that the regulations in this book reflect a later era. Many would simply be inapplicable to a nation migrating through a desert wilderness. Anachronism aside, moralists and others not reluctant to make value judgments may well find parts of the code barbaric at any time. The code is extremely free, for example, in imposing the death penalty. Thus, he who insults his father or his mother shall be put to death. And it is shockingly tolerant, not just of slavery as an institution, but of abuses within slavery. Thus, when a slave owner strikes a male or female slave with a rod and the slave dies immediately, the owner shall be punished. But if the slave survives a day or two, there is no punishment, for the slave is the owner's property. Many of the regulations assume that interpersonal violence is a part of life and merely try to codify it, not forbid it. Thus, in a passage that contains one of the most quoted lines in the Bible, "When men fight, and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him, the payment to be based on reckoning. But if other damage ensues, the penalty shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise." The point of this lex talionis, or law of suchness, is that you shall not give two eyes for an eye, or an eye for a burn. To that extent, the code may have been, in its day, a huge step in the right direction, that is, away from vindictiveness and revenge. And yet most modern readers would more easily see the many more steps waiting to be taken. As a statement about the Lord, who has imposed these regulations through Moses, "These are the rules that you shall set before them," the Book of the Covenant is, in other words, something less than the best possible recommendation. But the step it takes in the right direction is for him a fateful first step. This is so because the giving of laws has an effect on the lawgiver as well as on the law receiver. God will never, in the course of the Bible, accept in so many words any obligations imposed upon him by mankind. However, he will impose obligations upon himself in function of those he imposes on mankind, and, by this process, he will move out of the realm of the purely arbitrary and into the realm of the bounded and lawful. In the distinctive double exposition of the Book of Exodus, Moses receives the laws once, smashes the tablets on which they are written, then ascends Sinai to receive them for a second time. On this second occasion, the giving of the law is not preceded by all the sound and fury that preceded it the first time. The only physical manifestations that occur are the cloud that surrounds the Lord as he comes to give Moses the law, and the blinding light that radiates from Moses' face when he descends from the mountain, having received it. The two tablets of the pact, stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. As immediate prelude to the giving of the law, Moses stands holding the still blank stone tablets on which God will write the law. The Lord then passes before him so that Moses may see his glory and offers a glorious formulation of his own identity. The Lord, a God compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in kindness and faithfulness, extending kindness to the thousandth generation, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he does not remit all punishment, but visits the iniquity of parents upon children and children's children, upon the third and fourth generations. Historical scholarship has located the term hesed, translated above by the phrase kindness and faithfulness, in ancient diplomacy rather than in personal relations. In the treaty between a suzerain and a vassal, hesed was the mutual promise of loyalty. Thus another translation sometimes seen is covenant fidelity. At the most basic level, hesed is the virtue of one whose word can be relied on. Within the context of his covenant with Israel, the Lord has hesed, which is to say that, though he is free, as he endlessly insists, to break the covenant, he will not break it. The Lord's stately description of himself as abounding in kindness and faithfulness, however, contains a certain tension. As we shall see, his covenant relationship with Israel and his more nearly personal relationship with Moses are deliberately confounded toward the end of the book of Exodus. Leaving that aside for the moment, there would appear to be an outright contradiction in the Lord's description of himself as forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he does not remit all punishment, but visits the iniquity of parents upon children and children's children upon the third and fourth generations. Which is it? Is he forgiving or is he vindictive? Strange and off-putting as the notion of visiting the iniquity of parents upon children rings in modern ears, it is as much an ethical step forward as any practical regulation in the Book of the Covenant. First of all, it is worth noting that the Lord extends his kindness to the thousandth generation, and visits iniquity only on the third and fourth. But to return to the discussion that opened this chapter, the rule of transgenerational punishment is, at a more basic level, ancient Israelite society's version of karma. In a worldview without an afterlife of rewards and punishments, the only punishment that could be inflicted on a criminal who died unpunished was through his children. The knowledge that revenge might be wreaked on one's children is a major deterrent to crime in some traditional societies even now. By placing the weight of his own power and authority behind that deterrent in Israel, God reassures his covenant partners that, as a part of his steadfast love toward them, he will do what it falls to the suzerain to do. Namely, enforce justice. And whatever the particular requirements of justice, or the particular methods of its enforcement, it is of permanent and fundamental importance that it is by his justice rather than some other good that God, just at the moment when his power is least in question, chooses to define himself. By implication, if God's goal is still to make mankind in his image, then the human inclination to subordinate morality to power, rules applying only to those not strong enough to break them, receives here an implicit challenge. If morality is ultimate for God, then it must be ultimate for man. There must be no level of human power or human wisdom at which justice ceases to be the final goal and supreme criterion. Only once before, at the judgment and punishment of Cain, has God assumed anything like the role he assumes here. He assumes it because otherwise the laws he is about to write on Moses' tablets would be unenforced and therefore meaningless. In a culture like ours, with an extremely strong sense of the individual and an ever-weaker sense of family, enforcement by visiting the iniquity of parents upon children is a repellent notion. By the same token, however, the promise of offspring as numerous as the stars in the sky is a somewhat puzzling one. As numerous as the stars of the sky, the modern reader asks, and what good will they all do me? I do not mean to make the modern reader sound crass, merely to point out that it is not only when it comes to justice that the early books of the Bible think transgenerationally. Clearly, for the patriarchs, the man who died with offspring had the only kind of immortality that it was possible to have. One who had many offspring, offspring as numerous as the stars, had not just immortality but also the equivalent of great renown. Children were the only magnification of the self that was commonly to be had. Modern society believes that children are not just extensions of their parents, but imagine a society that believed the opposite. What if everyone thought of children as the true continuation of their parents? In that case, it would be as reasonable for children to inherit punishment as in ours it is for them to inherit property. In Exodus 34:6-7, this is the view that obtains. Eventually, God will actively break with this intergenerational moral anthropology, so to call it. But even in this passage, what he means to reveal to Moses is the very opposite of wanton cruelty. He means to reveal as eloquently as possible that he is a God who attaches supreme importance to justice and will be utterly relentless in its pursuit. The fourth crescendo in the latter half of the book of Exodus is an intensification in Moses' personal relationship with God. What makes God's character distinctive, as we have noted repeatedly, is its combination of the lofty and relatively impersonal personalities of world creator and world destroyer with the humbler and more intimate one of personal advocate. God does not renounce any of these earlier personalities when he becomes warrior and lawgiver. Rather, by remaining a personal God, he personalizes his very lawgiving and war-making. Concretely speaking, he inserts them into his relationship with Moses. Kindness and faithfulness, though the phrase may generally refer to reliability in keeping a covenant, has been used once at this point in the Bible to characterize God's relationship with an individual man. The man was Joseph. Significantly, Moses brings Joseph's bones with him from Egypt during the Exodus and will entrust them to his lieutenant, Joshua. Like Joseph, Moses narrowly escaped early death and spent many years in the company of Egyptians. Moses, who has an Egyptian name and for whom, most unusually, no father's or mother's name is reported, is Joseph's spiritual heir. God's unique bond to Moses comes to the fore after the Israelites' idolatry, during a long period when Moses is alone with the Lord on the mountaintop. The Lord announces that he will no longer dwell with Israel. He will send an angel to drive out their enemies, but, he says, I will not go in your midst, since you are a stiff-necked people, lest I destroy you on the way. Moses urges the Lord to change his mind. For how shall it be known that your people have gained your favor unless you go with us, so that we may be distinguished, your people and I, from every people on the face of the earth? The possibility that the Lord may no longer reside with Israel has the paradoxical but surely intended effect of drawing attention to the fact that he has taken up residence in the first place. The Lord visited the patriarchs, often by night or in dreams. He did not travel with them or have any symbolic dwelling place in their encampments. Post-Exodus, the Lord has declared his intention to occupy a meticulously appointed pavilion among the tents of Israel. As he now reconsiders this plan, attention is automatically focused on it. The Lord relents. He will go up to Canaan with Israel after all. But he relents in a way that inscribes the law-bound relationship he has with Israel within a deepening personal relationship with Moses, a relationship that amounts to a more intense, greatly extended version of the God of theophanies that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob experienced. The Lord said to Moses, I will do the very thing that you have asked, for you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you the name Yahweh. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no one shall see me and live. And the Lord continued, See, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. God's speech is riven by an emotional, if not quite a logical, contradiction. At the very moment when he is declaring something like love for Moses, you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name, and bringing Moses into a carefully protected physical intimacy with himself, God is insisting on his sovereign right not to do what he is doing. The words, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, are in effect an ungracious and gratuitous boast coming just at this moment. But the action speaks louder than those words. We have read a moment earlier that the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, as one speaks to a friend. And the intimacy of the scene that follows is matched in mood perhaps only by Jacob wrestling with his nocturnal visitor. The fact that the Lord wants to be seen only from behind may suggest that he is concealing his genitalia from Moses. The word kabod can have a spiritual meaning. Its usual translation is glory, but also a visceral one. It is the standard word for liver. According to the eminent linguist and Bible scholar Marvin H. Pope, kabod probably alludes to the male genitalia at Job 29:20, where glory is still the correct translation, even though genitalia are to be understood. The word kabod here may well have the same double meaning. That possibility aside, however, the scene confirms in the strongest possible way Moses' physical closeness to the Lord. And so, in a fourth instance, the double exposition of the book of Exodus has made possible something that single exposition would have precluded. At the first giving of the law, the covenant is between the Lord and Israel, and the law is merely transmitted through Moses. After the Israelites commit idolatry, however, the law is truly given to Moses. The Israelites are not asked to give their consent. It is as if, when the Lord looks at Israel, what he sees is Moses. The personalization, or as it almost seems, the repersonalization of God's activity in his relationship with Moses, is the note on which the book of Exodus closes. As we have observed, many parts of 25:1 through 31:18, dealing with God's tabernacle or dwelling tent, and with the priests who will serve him there, are repeated verbatim in 35:1 through 40:38. Much of the time, instructions given in the earlier section are actually enacted in the later one. One section that occurs only in the latter section, however, is 40:16 through 33, near the close of the book, in which Moses himself, rather than the craftsmen Bezalel and Oholiab, assembles God's tabernacle. Having done that, he takes the tablets of the law, called in the text simply the covenant, puts them in their cabinet, the ark, and places the cover, or mercy seat, atop the ark inside the tabernacle. The Lord has forbidden the Israelites to make an image of him, but they are permitted to make a throne for him and to adorn it with the winged creatures or cherubim understood to attend him in heaven. At the end of the book of Exodus, after Moses personally has attended to all these arrangements, the Lord God finally seats himself on his throne. When Moses had finished the work, the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle. When the cloud lifted from the tabernacle, the Israelites would set out on their various journeys. But if the cloud did not lift, they would not set out until such time as it did lift. For over the tabernacle a cloud of the Lord rested by day, and fire would appear in it by night, in the view of all the house of Israel throughout their journeys. Nothing in nature looks like cloud by day and fire by night, except a volcano. The depth of the Lord God's compelling but contradictory power is well evoked by the extraordinary image of a volcano brought into a tent. The concern of the last so-called priestly editors of the Book of Exodus for liturgical punctilio ends by heightening this very contrast. The power of a being who, by all that is personally and characterologically right, should be sweeping all law aside like the irresistible force of nature that he is, has somehow been harnessed for the enforcement of law. And it is a personal relationship with one man that has brought this about. The volcano has come to live in the tent because the tent was built by the volcano's friend. Liege. The foreskin of your heart. Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. For a critic writing a literary biography of God, little compares in interest with the portions of his story that we have considered to this point. For, as in any ordinary life story, the beginning is crucial. The books of Genesis and Exodus are, in some sense, God's childhood. It is in them that his basic identity is formed. The changes that take place in such swift succession in these two books are, like the changes of childhood, large and dramatic. They deserve close attention. God changes less in the biblical books that immediately follow, and the literary biographer has less need to talk about them. The first five books of the Bible are called, in Jewish tradition, the Torah, a Hebrew word meaning roughly teaching, and in secular scholarship, the Pentateuch, from a Greek word meaning Book of Five. Genesis, the first book of the Pentateuch, begins as God creates the world. Exodus, the second book of the Pentateuch, ends 1 year to the day after the escape from Egypt. On that day, God moves into the tabernacle or dwelling prepared for him by Moses. The cloud covered the tent of meeting, we read, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it, and the presence of the Lord filled the tabernacle. The remainder of the story that the Pentateuch has to tell about the Israelites in the desert is told in Numbers, the fourth book of the Pentateuch. There we read that 1 month after the Lord has taken up residence in the tabernacle, he orders a census, whence the title, the Book of Numbers, of the Israelites encamped with him at Sinai. After the census, on the 20th day of the second month in the second year, the cloud lifted from the tabernacle of the pact, and the Israelites set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. The rest of the Book of Numbers recounts Israel's wanderings in the desert, the first sorties into Canaan, roughly the area of present-day Israel, from the south. The subsequent decision to invade Canaan across the Jordan River from the east. And, en route to that invasion, the victories over Heshbon and Bashan, two small Amorite kingdoms on the east side of the Jordan River, in present-day Jordan. The narrative ends with Israel encamped in its newly conquered territory, preparing for the invasion of the Canaanite heartland. Flanking this narrative are the third and fifth books of the Pentateuch, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, each a book-length speech by the Lord to Moses, Leviticus, or by Moses to the Israelites, Deuteronomy. The first is given at Sinai, just before the Israelites begin their trek toward Canaan. The second, Moses' last words before his death, is given on the plains of Moab, along the east bank of the Jordan River, opposite Jericho. Leviticus. Like the far briefer Book of the Covenant section in the Book of Exodus, the Book of Leviticus reflects the customs of a later era, written down in a still later era. In 587 BCE, some 600 years after the conquest of Canaan, Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the Israelites were carried into captivity. It was in Babylon that the priests of Jerusalem, the only effective Israelite leaders left after the conquest, attempted to codify the life that the nation had led in its lost homeland. The results, in a highly structured and at times almost abstract presentation, lay great stress, not surprisingly, on that part of the national life which was the priest's special province, namely religious ritual. The priests were all of the house of Levi, whence the title of the book. The religious rituals described are concerned with purification and exculpation, both of these being aspects of the same concern. That Israel as a nation and each individual Israelite remain in covenant with the Lord. A comparison of Leviticus 19, an expanded version of the Decalogue, with Exodus 20, the first statement of the Decalogue, may make the distinctive emphasis of Leviticus clear. In Exodus at Mount Sinai, there is a clear, indeed overpowering sense of the otherness, the numinous strangeness of the Lord. The Israelites are no less excluded from that otherness than is the rest of mankind. Only Moses has access to it. In Leviticus, the line is differently drawn. God and Israel together are other, and the rest of mankind, in some sense the rest of reality, is excluded. The list of commands in Leviticus begins, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Secularity as a tradition, beginning with the Enlightenment, is, of course, unknown in the Bible. And yet, in different books, at different moments, human relations may vary in the degree to which they are encased in the divine-human relation. Thus, warfare was, for the patriarchs, a relatively secular undertaking. In the book of Leviticus, by contrast, everything that sets Israel visibly apart from other nations, and a great deal is designed to do exactly that, concerns God, who set Israel apart in the first place. And by the same token, everything that might divide one Israelite from another disturbs the perfection of the covenant between Israel and God, and therefore, once again, concerns God. All the actions of ordinary living are sacralized by being interpreted as actions involving God. But all key, prescribed measures are predictable and efficacious, and all are ultimately benevolent. However repetitious and therefore tedious to read the many rituals may be for a modern reader, they do present collectively a distinctively serene and idealized picture of national life. Nothing goes wrong that cannot be set aright by the proper ritual. And since no tale is told of anyone declining to perform the ritual, the subtle implication is that no one ever did. Historians postulate that the priestly redactors who produced the Pentateuch by combining and greatly supplementing earlier texts made the Book of Leviticus a long speech by the Lord at Sinai as a way of claiming the highest authority for their ritual practices. That will do as a historical explanation, but once the text is so placed, once God is the one who speaks it, It becomes a statement about him as well as one by him. Any speech inevitably characterizes the speaker. Following just after the storms of the Book of Exodus, the Book of Leviticus comes as a lull. The God whom the Book of Exodus presented was a frightening God. His presence among the tents of Israel, cloud by day and fire by night, was potentially menacing. But if the Lord's very consent to house himself in the tabernacle was a literal domestication, the Book of Leviticus suggests a much more elaborate and symbolic domestication. Though fearing the Lord at every turn and building on that fear in others, the priests have contained the object of their fear in a complex set of rituals designed to guarantee Israel's purity, immunity, and safety. In the way of much liturgy, the very tedium soothes. One cannot be bored and terrified at once. Or, to put a somewhat less sharp point on it, one cannot simultaneously be paralyzed with fear and punctilious in observing the rubrics. Leviticus thus comes as a kind of breather in God's story. The Lord's tone of voice as speaker is many registers away from the tone heard at Sinai. And, tone aside, the content of what he says, looking forward to the life his people will lead in the land he will give them, makes it clear that he will not always be as frightening as he has lately seemed. During the opening 6 chapters on sacrifice rituals, though he refers to himself frequently, he always refers to himself in the third person. During the long section on cleanliness and uncleanliness, chapters 11 through 16, even third-person references are missing. There is only the opening, formulaic, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying." For historical criticism, God's absence from the body of these speeches is a clear indication that the text was not originally written as divine speech. However, having now been rewritten to function as such, it cannot fail to interrupt the momentum of the rampant subjectivity that made the Lord so terrifying at Sinai. "Let not the priests or the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them," we read at Exodus 19:24. "And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy," at Exodus 33:19.